You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's budget time in the nation's capital. We'll look at the national debt and how plans from Congress and the president could affect it. Now we travel with our taste buds to Poland. It's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're going to talk to the owner of Door County's only Polish restaurant. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Polish cuisine? Do you have Polish heritage, enthusiasm for Polish food? Did you grow up eating pierogi and other Polish foods? Do you make it yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christoph Kroll is founder, owner, and head chef of Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim. Christoph, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Now, you're originally from Poland. I understand you're back visiting Poland right now. What brought you to Wisconsin?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, I'm currently in Poland. Came back for a three-week visit. What brought me to Wisconsin was a foreign exchange program from a university back home called Work and Travel. Door County hosts about 200 J-1 visa exchange students each summer, and I was one of them. And my first summer was in 2012.
What made you decide to end up staying in Door County and opening up a restaurant there?
Oh, believe me or not, but the first experience in America in Door County just made me realize that this is my second home now and that I want to continue my adventure here in America. A lot of cultural differences that I was met with when I first came. Notice how friendly and open-minded people are. How friendly Midwesterns are. I had the opportunity to go to a cultural exchange program to South Korea or Belgium later on, but that would have meant I couldn't have gone back to Door County for the summer, and I never wanted to miss out on it again. And since that first summer, I spent 11 consecutive summers in the U.S., having moved to Door County permanently in 2015.
You grew up.
And then, and then the story continues with me starting the restaurant. I just basically wanted to contribute to the community. And I dug in on the things that I could do best. And I have worked for numerous years in the restaurant industry. I have a passion for cooking and for entrepreneurship, and I've decided to fill in a gap in the market of a Polish cuisine in Wisconsin, since I've always believed we were underrepresented as a nation, despite the huge heritage, and decided to purchase an old building and turn it into a Polish restaurant.
Now, of course, you grew up with Polish food in Poland. Can you talk about how you learned about these foods from your mom, I understand, and your grandma?
Exactly. So first of all, the culture of eating out in Poland is not big at all. Me and my family of four, we possibly went out to eat once in my entire life growing up in Poland with my mom, my dad, and my sister. The reason for it is restaurants don't have the greatest reputation back home, since most of moms are housewives and they cook all of the homemade meals at home. And I've been around it all my life since my mom gave up her career. She has a master's degree in economics, and she dedicated herself to taking care of me and my sister and the house. Which included making fresh home-cooked meals every day. So in order to spend more time with my mom, I would gladly join her in the kitchen so we can talk about school, life, wait till dad comes back from work, and then enjoy dinner together.
We're talking to Christoph Kroll. It's Food Friday. Christoph is head chef at Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim in Door County. He's sharing Polish cuisine with us, some ingredients, some recipes coming up, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite Polish food, if you grew up with it, if you have questions about making it, call 800-642-1234. Okay, Krzysztof, if I say Polish food to people, a lot of them, probably me too, will think pierogi. I grew up eating them. My Polish grandma cooked them all the time. What is the secret to making a great pierogi? Or pierog is singular, to make a great pierogi plural.
So the secret is, I'm going to have to say, you're not going to be great at it from the get-go. It takes a little bit of time and experience. It's a time-consuming process. Since you make the dough from scratch, you make the filling from scratch, and then you have to wrap it correctly, pinch it so it doesn't open up in a boiling water or a pan fry. So give yourself some credit for, taking on this task. My secret would be the advice to people: divide the prep process into stages. Don't try to make the entire meal in 2 hours. It's going to be extremely difficult, and it's not really worth the time to make just one pierog or 10 pierogi. You need to make a few. And it's a very fun bonding activity that you could do with family members, friends, which is very common in Wisconsin. From what I've been hearing from my patrons, is that they often gather together for Christmas Eve time or Easter just to make pierogies for the holiday season. And you just make a lot of them. So first, I would concentrate on the dough. Remember that flour makes things dry and water wet. So you just need a perfect combination of boiling water, salt, flour, preferably unbleached flour, and then a little bit of vegetable oil. And I practice this recipe just because it's vegan and I offer some vegan pierogies at my restaurant. So once you prepare the dough, then you have to create dough circles. You can use a glass to create dough circles that you'll wrap your filling into. And I recommend using parchment paper with flour so the dough circles do not stick to each other, so they can be used later on the next day. They could be up in the fridge up to 7 days. In the meantime, you'll make the filling fresh, and then you'll hand wrap them. You can use pinchers from Amazon or eBay. I highly recommend those. You just need to focus on the double pinch when you're closing the pierogi, just so they don't open up in the water, because then you'll just get the dough and the filling will disintegrate.
I tried to make pierogies myself exactly once, and that's what I ended up with: floating dough and filling at the top of the pot. It was not a thing anybody was going to eat. Let's talk about fillings now. I grew up with the sauerkraut, like the cheese, the kind of cream cheese deal, like cheese, and then potato. Now you have experimented with some other stuff for your Door County restaurant. What other things have you played with for your fillings?
Oh, so many things. This is one of my favorite things to do and talk about, is practice different pierogi recipes. There's so much different cuisine available here in the U.S. that I could learn from. And I went on some classic Wisconsin fillings, such as bacon mac and cheese, comfort food inside of Polish comfort food, pierogi. Kids love that special. I make Door County cherry and cream cheese pierogies, also for the local people in Door County. Potato cheddar jalapeno would be a little bit of a Hispanic fusion. Sauerkraut mushroom and kielbasa, the classic sauerkraut mushroom pierogi that you mentioned, mixed with our traditional Polish sausage. Some dessert pierogies covered with powdered sugar, chocolate or caramel drizzle, and whipped cream. The fillings would be banana and Nutella, a little chocolate banana pierogi, or wild blueberry. Even seasonal pierogies in the fall, like pumpkin spice, feature our menu. Spinach and feta is very light and fresh. Potato onion, another vegan pierogi. And also the classic cheese and potato, farmer's cheese, potato, and caramelized onion, or slow roasted pork. We've made them with beef and cheese before, but I've learned that the beef is a little bit too dry for a dumpling that you boil in water, if that makes sense.
I got to ask, Krzysztof, you're back in Poland. you tell people, yeah, I'm making pumpkin spice pierogi and bacon mac and cheeseburger. Are they like, that sounds great, Christoph, make it for us? Or are they like, what the heck are you doing to our pierogi?
That's a great question. Bacon mac and cheese is not a thing in Poland, really. I never grew up with it. I never grew up with ranch dressing or classic items on American tables. So I've never made those contemporary pierogies at home for, friends and family. They would be open to try it, although it just, like with your favorite foods, let's say a cheeseburger, it's good the way it is. You don't necessarily have to add too many things as a connoisseur. So I think for me, my personal favorite pierogi is cheese and potato. And every time I'm somewhere outside of Poland that has a Polish restaurant, I'm definitely going to try that flavor first because this is our staple.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about Polish cooking with Christoph Kroll from the Prince of Pierogi restaurant in Ephraim in Door County. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have our guest about making Polish food at home? And I know we got some Polish heritage here in Wisconsin. Anybody have a story to share about foods you ate growing up, foods you make now, or maybe like me, have tried and failed to make over the years? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Christoph Kroll, founder, owner, and head chef at Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim in Door County. It's Food Friday, and he's telling us about Polish cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question about the foods, the ingredients, the recipes in Polish cuisine, maybe your own experiences, maybe growing up with it or encountering it in your travels. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's turn now, Christoph, to cabbage rolls, gwumkis, we called them. I don't know if we pronounced it right, the Polish growing up. Can you tell us about these Polish cabbage rolls?
Yes, you nailed it. It's pronounced gwumkis. At our restaurant, we have a nickname for them. We call them Polish burritos. It's basically a cabbage leaf peeled and wrapped around ground beef or pork, rice, tomato sauce, sauteed onions, sometimes mushrooms, parsley, salt, and pepper. Then you bake them for about an hour and a half. They come topped with a marinara sauce, but they don't have to, sour cream, and a little bit of dill on top. It's one of my favorite comfort foods. You could eat it with a knife and fork, or you don't. You can just use your hands. It's very popular in Poland. I would say it's our second most popular dish besides pierogies. It's really good and hearty on a cold day, but it also doesn't hurt to have one in the summer.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. Evelyn is with us in Green Bay. Evelyn, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm enjoying the program. I'm familiar with his place as we go off into our county quite often. But in the pierogi dough, do you put any egg in there?
So you say eggs in the
I
dough,
do
Evelyn? No, okay.
Yeah.
But you could. I have a recipe called Perfect. I have a book called Perfect Pierogi Dough Recipes, and there are a few recipes in there that include an egg-based dough. If you ever stop in at the restaurant, feel free to send me a message. I could pick up the book and share some of these recipes with you.
Thanks a lot, Evelyn, for calling in. Peter is with us now in Burlington. Peter, hi.
Hello. Just wanted to comment on the pierogi because I grew up in a Polish household where Christmas is not Christmas without pierogi. And I'm the youngest of eight, so we would make quite a few pierogi, as you can imagine. But we always made them with, we still make them with sauerkraut and onion mixture. And just to Evelyn's comment about the egg, I found that if I just rub a little egg on the edge, I don't have them break open when I boil them, too. So.
And Peter, are you did you eat them on Christmas Day or Christmas Eve? Because we did Christmas Eve with the pierogi.
Yeah, absolutely, Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve was our Christmas feast and celebration, and the pierogi making process would begin Christmas Eve. And hopefully there would be some leftovers for Christmas Day.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, and Christoph, our thing was we'd eat the, you know, we'd have the Christmas Eve meal earlier in the day, and we'd all hang out for some hours. And at some point, somebody sneaks back into the fridge and breaks out the leftovers and is round two on the pierogi. Can you talk about holiday traditions around some of these foods, Christoph?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's just the same in Poland. It's very, very big for Christmas. There's no Christmas without pierogi. One of the staples for a Polish Christmas is borscht, which is a beet soup that you eat with little dumplings. Every Polish dinner table for Christmas Eve has to have at least a variety of 13 different dishes. That's the tradition. You always have to have an extra setup for just in case a stranger or a traveler shows up at your door. So you're obligated to host him to your family's Christmas dinner. The most popular pierogi for Christmas is sauerkraut and mushroom pierogi. And it's a family gathering. It's probably the biggest. Poland is a Catholic country, 99% Catholic country. So it's a very big event in every Polish family.
Peter, thanks a lot for sharing your experience at 800-642-1234. Dr. Christoph Kroll with the Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim in Door County on this edition of Food Friday. Back to your calls now with Laura in Cudahy. Laura, hello.
Hi. In 2014, my husband and I had included Poland as part of our travels that summer, and we ate a lot of pierogi while we were there. And a couple weeks after we got back from vacation, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had an article about a family and their pierogi making, and they had a recipe for pierogi. And so I tried it. And as I make it more and more often, I get better and better at it. And it's probably now my favorite meal to make. My husband and I actually have enjoyed pierogi twice this week.
Awesome. Laura, what is the favorite filling in your household?
Well, we have two. Our very favorite is spinach, garlic, a little bit of Asaggio cheese, and sour cream. And then I also like to make one with potato, leek, carrot, and cabbage, and a little bit of cheese.
Wow. Laura, thanks for sharing that. Christoph, Laura is experimenting kind of the same way you are at your restaurant.
Sounds delicious. And it really warms my heart to hear people trying to apply different ingredients into pierogies. Owning Prince of Pierogi Restaurant made me realize how important this food is, how important the heritage is to American people. And it's really great to hear all different ideas because I learned from people too. So many recipes that people shared with me, I would say it's been at least a 50 different pierogi recipes so far, just only inspired me to create different specials and try them out for myself.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laura. And I want to turn to another dish that I got to say I didn't grow up with, the hunter's stew. I like stew. What goes into a Polish hunter's stew?
Mm-hmm. So Polish hunter stew, it's called bigos. It has its own name, bigos. It's a mix of fermented cabbage, sauerkraut, and fresh cabbage, tomatoes, mushrooms, onions, and a variety of meats. That's what makes it a hunter stew. So whether it's venison, ground beef, kielbasa is a must. You could put pork, and it's a tomato-based stew. That you cook with beef broth with a variety of spices such as parsley, smoked paprika, salt, pepper, basil, rosemary, bay leaf. You slow cook the hunter stew for hours. It's served with warm bread. It makes a great meal. It's a hearty meal. It's very traditional to Polish cuisine. In any list of the top most popular Polish foods, you will frequently see the hunter stew being featured in top five among pierogies and golumkis.
Time for one more caller. Tom is with us calling from on the road. Tom, hi.
Hey, I grew up in a Polish family in Chicago. I played at the Shanties Festivals in Krakow and Warsaw, and I live in Madison, which has the most incredible food, I think, in America. But why are there no Polish restaurants in Madison? We need you.
Tom, thanks for the call. Christoph, I don't know if we can lure you out of Door County at all, but you saw that. That's part of why you're opening your restaurant. You saw a very low Polish restaurant per capita ratio here in Wisconsin.
Exactly. That's what really motivated me to represent my culture, represent my home country, and you know, be in my favorite place in the world, which is Door County, Wisconsin. I would be easily persuaded to venture out to different cities in the U.S. And I'm not going to say I have some dreams for the future to expand the restaurant and carry on this brand to other cities. However, for now, I'm just focusing on my little restaurant in Ephraim in Door County, since it's going to be my year four. So I'm still focusing on the reviews online, on creating the best possible experience for each guest, on mastering all of the ingredients that go into a perfect customer experience. And only when I'm super comfortable with letting my little restaurant be run by my staff, only then I will be courageous enough to try open another restaurant in another city in Wisconsin.
Excellent. Thanks for that call. Thanks for that call. And Christoph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
That's Christoph Kroll, owner of Prince of Pierogi Restaurant in Ephraim in Door County. We talked to him today about Polish cooking for this week's edition of Food Friday. You can keep sharing your Polish food favorites and experiences on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And hey, for more food-related conversations, check out the morning show this month every Tuesday at 8, talking about cooking tools. The first one, if you check out the archives, knives, and cutting boards. Next up, it's copper cookware and induction stovetops. That's Tuesday mornings at 8. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, protests grow in France, TikTok goes to Congress, and Israel receives a rare rebuke from its strongest ally. It's a Friday news roundup today at 6 on 1A+. Now, President Biden released his budget proposal last month, and Congress is on the clock with a deadline to release budget plans by April 15th. The Democratic president and the Republican House are likely to have big differences, and there's a risk of a debt ceiling standoff over key issues. And looming over all of that, a big national debt, over $31 trillion worth, and concerns about annual deficits adding to that tally. Our next guest is with a federal budget watchdog group with us for a look at tax and spending alternatives and what they would mean for the debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about the national debt? Are there things you want to see change on the tax or spending sides of things? Are there changes that should be off the table? Social Security, the Trump-era tax cuts? Or are there tax spending cuts or tax increases you do want to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Goldwine is Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I gave a very broad number there. Can you give us the current state of the debt and the direction it's moving in?
Oh, well, it is not pretty. I like to measure the debt relative to the size of the economy, and it's pretty close. It's at about 97-98%. Within 5 years, the debt is going to be at a new record, 106, even higher than it was after World War II.
How big an impact did COVID-related emergency spending have?
So in total, we spent about $5 trillion on COVID-related emergencies, which is a good 10% of the economy. And so without, you know, everything, all those numbers I told you, that 106, maybe it would be 95 without the COVID emergency, which is still quite high.
We see often parties when they come into power being less worried about debt than when they're out of power. Why should we take this debt seriously, no matter which political party might be running the White House and Congress?
Yeah, I do think that's the huge political problem, right, is Republicans love cutting taxes. Democrats love increasing spending, and they love beating each other over the head over adding to the deficit, but not really looking in the mirror. The problem is everyone's looking at the next election. Nobody's looking at the next generation. And this debt really starts to eat at our economic growth. It's part of the reason inflation is so high right now because of that deficit spending. And it's part of the reason that interest rates are rising.
We have the president's budget proposal. It offers, at least they claim, about $3 trillion in deficit reduction over 10 years. Does it do that, or at least ish? And if so, where is that coming from?
Ish. So first of all, $3 trillion would be a really good start. We would need about $16 trillion to balance the budget. We need about $8 trillion to stabilize the debt, which I think is what our goal should be. So $3 trillion is, it's not a drop in the bucket. It's a real start, but it's only a start. The president's budget gets there mainly through tax increases. They actually have about $5 trillion of tax increases, along with about $500 billion of savings from the spending side. But they spend a lot of that on new initiatives for childcare, for college, for healthcare, you name it. And so they're left with $3 trillion. That $3 trillion, you know, I think an independent estimate would come up with more like two, but it's real deficit reduction.
Now, the president's budget doesn't matter if Congress doesn't pass it. Republicans control one of the chambers of Congress. Now, there's this April 15th deadline. They're supposed to have a congressional budget, but we don't seem to take our budgeting real seriously anymore in terms of meeting deadlines and that sort of thing.
That's right. The president was a month late with his budget. Congress, I've heard some rumors, is not even going to try to put forward a budget, which is pretty nuts. We haven't had, we haven't seriously used the budget process to actually try to figure out our tax and spending priorities in 15 years or so. The budget process is so broken that we're lucky if we can actually avoid a government shutdown before October 1st.
That's the shutdown. And then there's this debt ceiling thing, ideas floating for some Republicans in the House to use the debt ceiling as a way to get some spending cuts. Now, some Republican leaders say, no, we're not going to do that. What do you think of that as a tactic to say, okay, we're going to risk this big debt ceiling chaos if we don't get the cuts that we want?
Well, first of all, the U.S. absolutely, without equivocation, needs to raise the debt limit. If we don't raise the debt limit, it means that the president either needs to break the law and stop spending money that he's required to spend, or we need to stop paying our creditors, in which case there's a global financial crisis. So we need to raise the debt limit. But historically, the debt limit has almost always been used as an opportunity to take stock of our fiscal situation. It was how we got the deficit reduction agreements, Graham-Rubin-Hollings in the 1985-1987. It's how we got the 1990 budget deal. It's how we got deficit reduction in 1997 and 2011. So it's actually pretty normal to use the debt ceiling as an opportunity to have a fiscal conversation. There's just a difference between having a fiscal conversation and threatening default. And we cannot threaten default under any circumstance.
Talking to Mark Goldwine from the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, looking at the state of the debt, the annual deficit, and budget negotiations in the White House and Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jed is with us in Le Coudray. Jed, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Jed?
I'm just wondering if your speaker or you thought, when can we ever look at the Pentagon budget or the defense budget as something we can actually touch, as opposed to healthcare and education and childcare? When can we ever look at certain things and hopefully just find some monies there? Just, I don't know.
I got you, Jed. Thanks for the call. And that takes us down the path of specific budget lines. Mark, let's start there with the military. Are there opportunities for cuts? Are they politically realistic?
I think absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of waste in our defense budget on weapon systems that are only there because they benefit some company in some congressional district, on bureaucracies that don't make sense, you know, on base schools inside the United States where there's perfectly good public schools, commissaries, all sorts of ways. And then we could think more broadly about force structure, right? Do we really need the size of military? So that absolutely should be on the table. We did have some reductions in military spending in the 2011, 12, 13 period. But since 2017, Democrats and Republicans have basically come together with a you scratch my back, I scratch yours, where we've dramatically increased both military spending and non-defense spending by about 40% since 2017. So we're going in the wrong direction.
Thanks for that call, Jed, at 800-642-1234. We heard via email, Dave in Winona, Minnesota says, please ask the specifics of how they plan to do that, cut the deficit. They either have to cut Social Security, health care, or defense, or raise taxes. Let's talk about Social Security and Medicare, the so-called entitlements. How do they factor into all of this, Mark?
Well, look, Social Security and Medicare are the two largest federal government programs. Defense is about the same size as Medicare. And so I don't think you can have a serious plan to address the debt that doesn't look at Social Security and Medicare. With Medicare, the really good news is there are so many policies that can reduce costs without meaningfully reducing benefits. For example, there's these great private Medicare Advantage plans. They're actually very efficient, and yet they cost the federal government more than the less efficient public Medicare, basically because they're overcharging. So there's room to get savings there. There's room to get lower spending on drugs by encouraging the use of more generics instead of name brand drugs. There's room right now, if you go to if you get dialysis in a dialysis center, Medicare pays less than if you do the exact same thing at a hospital. That doesn't make any sense. And so there's a ton of room for efficiencies in healthcare. And I do hope that's a place where the parties can come together, because both Presidents Obama and Trump proposed a lot of these reforms in their own budgets.
We're talking to Mark Goldwine at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, looking at the national debt and the big choices in the current federal budget negotiations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Cuts you do or don't want to see, tax changes you do or don't want to see, call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, looking at the current state of the national debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Mark, before we go back to our callers, you have a thing on your group's website where people can play the home version of the federal budget. Can you tell us about the debt fixer program you have up there?
Yeah, absolutely. Go to crfb.org, and we actually have two very cool tools. One's called the Debt Fixer, and that lets you look at ways to cut defense, reform Social Security, lower healthcare costs, and raise taxes in order to get the debt on a more sustainable path. The other tool we have is called the Social Security Reformer. And I think as many folks know, Social Security is only about 10 years from insolvency, which means the trust fund is going to run out. The reformer lets you adjust the benefit levels, the taxes coming in, the retirement age, to build your own plan to make Social Security sustainable and prevent that insolvency.
Got a link to the debt fixer up at WPR.org/Central Time. Back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Monona. Rick, hello. I'm sorry. Rick in Monona. Hi.
Hi. This isn't exactly cheering me up. It doesn't sound good. And my question is this: what if we don't deal with this? What is that, a really dark future we're looking at?
Rick, you're asking a great question. I'm going to tell you the truth is we don't know. Let me tell you the best case scenario, which isn't all that great. The best case scenario is the United States, as the strongest economy in the world that borrows in our own currency, can stumble along like this forever. And in that scenario, the higher debt, it does something called crowd out investment. Basically, people buy bonds instead of investing in the private sector. So in that scenario, our economic growth just keeps slowing. Our wage growth keeps slowing. A larger and larger share of our budget goes to interest. In fact, interest is on course to be the single largest government program in 25 years' time, larger than defense, larger than Social Security. So the best case scenario is we stumble along, and this just cuts into our ability to grow and invest. The worst case scenario is we have a fiscal crisis. And the banking crisis we just saw a couple of weeks ago, is kind of a good microcosm of that. What we saw at Silicon Valley Bank was they had a bunch of low-yielding government bonds. And when the interest rate went up, those lost value, and then the banks lost value. imagine a scenario where interest rates really spiked, so the value of portfolios around the globe were declining. That could cause a global financial crisis, a fiscal crisis, if you will, something maybe that looks like the Great Recession or even worse.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Rod joins us now in La Crosse. Rod, hello.
Hello. I was an honorary discharge USMC at 77. But I seen probably 10 years ago or maybe longer, maybe less. But I seen, I'm pretty sure it was a PBS broadcast they had on television. They had a pie on there. It showed how much everybody was getting. And they showed like welfare was like maybe a pinch, maybe an eighth of an inch on that pie. And then they sat there and they showed what they were given for, you know, taking care of like roads and all this stuff. But more than three quarters of that was to the military. Now that's all the taxpayers' money going to that military stuff. Now, when these guys sit there and they crash a jet that costs umpteen millions of dollars, why do they not sit there and have to pay that money back to the people they sit there and they just stole it from?
Rod, thanks for the call. Now, Mark, I'm assuming that graph was what we call discretionary income. I assume a chart that included Social Security and Medicare would look different. But Rod's point, military, a big piece of the pie.
That's right. I mean, military is large, and we need to find ways to rein in some of the spending, as I mentioned. But it's about 15% of the total budget. The largest share of the budget actually goes to seniors for Social Security and Medicare. In fact, the federal government spends $6 per senior for every $1 they spend for kids. And a lot of that makes sense because, you know, we have a health and retirement program specifically designed to support seniors that they pay into. But it's also very costly, and those costs are getting larger as we get older as a population and as our healthcare costs continue to grow.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rod. Mark, something I wanted to ask you about before we run out of time. You testified, I believe, recently before Congress on the impact of the Biden administration's attempt to forgive at least some portion of student loan debt. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, so I don't think people are aware that not only has President Biden called for canceling $10,000 or $20,000 of debt per person, but they've also taken a lot of other measures, including changes to the income-driven repayment, a bunch of targeted cancellations, this long pause. We added them all up. It's almost $1 trillion. The student debt actions since the pandemic have cost $970 billion. That's actually more money than the federal government spent on higher education for its entire history prior to the pandemic. It's three times the cost of the Pell Grants. And when we've looked at what we're getting in return, a lot of this money is going to support doctors and lawyers and MBAs. The money looks like it's going to increase the rate of inflation, increase recession risk. Some of it's going to help people that really need it, but it's so poorly targeted that, in my opinion, and this is what I testified, I think it's really going to undermine the goals it's trying to achieve, make college more expensive and less affordable, and lower quality of education going forward.
And turning back to the big picture, Mark, bringing the deficit, the annual deficit down, putting a dent in that debt is going to require clearly cooperation between both parties in Congress and the White House. And people may hear that and say, so it's not going to happen at all. Do you have any sense of optimism that, in fact, that could happen?
Well, I'm optimistic on two fronts right now. The one is we have to decide how much to appropriate next year. And I do think we're going to stop this practice of Democrats getting a 10% non-defense cut, Democrats getting a 10% non-defense increase in exchange for Republicans getting a 10% defense increase. I think we are gonna turn down the hose on the out of control appropriations. The other sense of optimism I have is that everybody understands healthcare costs are too high, and there's an increasingly good understanding of where those excessive costs are. And so I do think there's opportunity for us to come together to reduce excessive spending for certain types of providers, prescription drugs, Medicare Advantage. And if we did that, not only would that reduce the deficit, it would actually reduce premiums and out-of-pocket costs for seniors as well.
Mark, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He joined us for a look at the latest on the national debt, the state of the federal budget deficit, and possible alternatives to bring it down. We have a link to that online debt fixer tool where you can come up with your own solutions at WPR.org/Central Time. in just 2 weeks. Wisconsin voters will choose a new state Supreme Court justice who will determine the ideological balance of the court for years to come. For a lot of voters, the right to access abortion is on the ballot. Anya Van Wagtendonk explains how the issue is bringing new energy to what might otherwise be a lower-key election.
On a freezing day in mid-March, several dozen rallygoers stand among snow piles in downtown Appleton. They're focused on rights they say are at stake in Wisconsin's pivotal state Supreme Court election. And for many in attendance, like Emma Keel, one issue stands out. That's because there's a good chance that whoever wins this election will hear a lawsuit over Wisconsin's abortion ban.
As a 26-year-old woman living in Wisconsin, I want to have autonomy over my body.
Wisconsin's court race has attracted national attention. Millions of dollars have poured in, and it's motivating voters like Whitney Bouchard, who might not normally be out in the cold for a race like this one.
This is new for me, yes. I've definitely supported Wisconsin politics in the past, but getting this involved is new to me, and I think I just realize how much of an impact these things have, and I don't think everybody does.
Ostensibly, this is a nonpartisan race. But the two candidates are favored by the two ends of the ideological spectrum. The conservative favorite, former Justice Dan Kelly, has done work for an anti-abortion group, while Judge Janet Protasiewicz has been outspoken in her support for abortion rights. Abortion's been outlawed here since last summer, when Roe v. Wade was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. That ruling reinstated a Wisconsin law first written in 1849 banning abortion. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call has filed a lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's ban. It's expected to go before the state Supreme Court at some point after the winner of this election is sworn into office.
I think Wisconsin's going to be kind of like a laboratory for both sides as they try to figure out how to influence state Supreme Court elections.
Mary Ziegler is a leading historian of the U.S. abortion debate. She says abortion was not a top issue for most voters before last year, but that's changed, especially in a state like Wisconsin.
You also have seen, I think, a shift in intensity of preference on abortion among a lot of Democrats. And I think some questions among some Republicans, especially around laws like Wisconsin's that don't have exceptions.
Ziegler says Wisconsin will be a model for other judiciary races going forward. Anti-abortion activists are aware of the stakes, and they're looking to preserve the legal victory they achieved last summer. Gracie Skogman, the legislative director of Wisconsin Right to Life, said she's never seen a response like this from anti-abortion activists.
This is the most impactful election for the pro-life base here in Wisconsin now that there is a tangible law that's on the line.
Douglas Keith is an attorney with the Brennan Center for Justice, which tracks spending in high court races. Keith says there's a reason the Wisconsin race has already shattered national records for spending.
Spending is increasing with the recognition that these courts are going to be the courts that are deciding some of the highest profile, most politically charged legal questions.
National groups have gotten involved in other ways, too. In January, the National Women's March held its flagship event in Madison to draw attention to the race. Jennifer Knox, the organizing director for Working Families Power, said the most important thing activists could do was invest some of their time in Wisconsin.
This is the single place in 2023 that really does reflect that abortion rights are on the ballot.
To hear Knox describe it, the stakes of the court race couldn't be more clear. She says whoever wins will decide whether abortion in Wisconsin is legal or not. Anya Van Wagtendonk, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday here on Central Time, a major international report gives a dire warning about the impact of climate change without immediate action. Why are governments and political systems slow to respond? Wisconsin researchers join us to tackle that question. And people often receive aggressive and invasive medical care toward the end of life, even if they and their families don't want it. We'll dig into a new investigation on end-of-life care and tough decisions along the way. That's Monday on Central Time.